Yeah, I need to stop on the hour anyway because I've actually got a massage booked for after this.
Well, that's priorities.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm needing a bit of self-love at the moment. So
That is self-care. That's
that's
wonderful.
my gift to myself.
Yes. And I need a manicure.
Nice.
My pedicure doesn't come till tomorrow, but Laura had to get to her massage, so we were limited to 1 hour, and I stretched it at that. I rang her up on Zoom. She's in the UK, and it was just delightful. You know, they say you do business with people that you know, like, and trust. Trust me, by the end of this conversation, you will know her, the real her. You will, it's she's impossible not to like, if not just like completely fall in love with, and you will trust her because she's a straight shooter. She's about clarity, she's about, you know, understanding a message that matters. She's in the marketing business, and we spend half the conversation before you even learn that. She's in the UK, and trust me, we talk zero about the royal, you know, festivities and the stuff that you couldn't miss on the TV. So, no coronation. You're welcome.
It highlights how much pain there really is in order to preserve such a perfect, flawless image.
This is In Her Words, a podcast from manlisting.com, featuring one man listening to the stories of real women in their own words. In Her Words, a conversation worth hearing, because every woman deserves to be heard.
Hey there, ho there. I'm Stuart Watson. This is In Her Words, the podcast this week. Oh, my word. I could listen to this woman read the phone book. I told her she needs a new career in voiceover work. She says her sister says she sounds posh. I don't think so. I think she's just the Queen's English without all the royalty. She is in the marketing business. You can find her in LinkedIn under Alara, A-L-A-R-A. Vural, V-U-R-A-L, half Turkish, half British. You hear for yourself. Amazing.
Where were you born?
So I was born in Marmaris in southwest Turkey.
For your mother, you're number what of how many?
I am the second of two. So I've got one older sister, 2 years older than me. And she is a gorgeous human being.
What, if anything, did your mother tell you about her pregnancy, labor, and delivery with you?
So I'm not 100% sure about the delivery itself, but I know that the pregnancy was because my mom had just got out of a divorce and she moved over to Turkey. Well, actually, she came to Turkey for a holiday and dad was the guide on the trip. So they had a little bit of a holiday romance. And she moved over to Turkey and kind of for very unromantic visa reasons, they got married. And it's funny because my dad and my mum have different aspects to this story. But my dad said, oh, you know, I was just saying to your mum, are we just going to stare at each other all day and all night? We should make some babies. So they made my sister. And then he said, and then once we had your sister, we're like, is this one just going to be alone? It's going to get born alone. We need to make another one. So I was brought in as the companion. Though my mum has a slightly different story. She explains it as just feeling ready to just have life as part of her, as part of her world. So I think it was more of an intuitive kind of wanting to have some, to create life. And both of us were quite an intuitive decision.
Why did they get married?
It was for very technical reasons, like visas and for mum to be able to, because I think previously she had to like leave the country every 3 months because of the visa that she was on. So after a while, I think they said, well, let's just get married and it means you can stay here for longer. I don't think either one of them romanticized the idea of marriage too much. So it was kind of very much a go to the registry office, signed a piece of paper. I think they had a little party at the end, but it was very, yeah, very technical reasons.
I know Americans who have established their citizenship in Ireland in order to get an EU passport because it makes things easier. But now I don't even know after Brexit, if does your passport still, like which passport is the most advantageous? Do you have a Turkish passport?
Yeah, so I have a Turkish citizenship, so I can live in Turkey if I want to. But yeah, so after Brexit, I can't live in Europe if I wanted to. So Turkey isn't actually in Europe, it's in Asia. It's trying to get into Europe, but I don't think they ever will. So there's only a tiny part of Turkey, which is the European side of Istanbul, that is technically in Europe, but as a country, it's not a European Union country. But anyway, so I can live in Turkey with my Turkish citizenship and my Turkish kind of passport. But yeah, can't live in Europe with my British passport.
Irrespective of whether you say that's my dad or that's my mom, are there things that you do or ways of seeing the world where when it comes up, you say, that's the Turkish in me?
Probably. So I love food and I love connecting over food and I love sharing food. And I have a very specific palate of food. I hate having like sweet in a main meal, like kind of, I think that there was like an orange duck, I think is like quite a popular, like, any Asian meals actually, like they tend to have sweet in the main meal. I just can't wrap my head around it. And my palate just does not accept it. So I'm very much kind of a savory, like tomato-y base, vegetable-y, olive oily meals. I have a lot of olive oil. but I think the other part of me that's the Turkish in me is I run with chaos. I don't have to have all my ducks in a row. I don't need everything planned. In fact, I thrive when kind of we're just rolling with it and making things up as we go. And I have a bit of a reputation for bodging like DIY jobs and stuff like that, because I'm just like, just if it works, if it's functional, that's what matters.
What is bodging?
Bodging is like basically doing kind of like the minimum you need to, with like, especially when it comes to like DIY jobs, like you're not doing the perfect job. You're doing kind of like yeah, I don't know. It's probably a British word, but yeah, you're basically just putting it all together and like doing the minimum possible. So it's functional, but it's not to the highest standard.
So perfectionists would have a really hard time with that.
I'm married to a perfectionist, so so he doesn't let me do the DIY jobs.
So when you go on vacation, how does that work, since he wants the schedule and the reservations and you were like, oh, it'll happen?
He's actually not so bad with kind of going on holiday. It's more kind of when there is a job to be done, he wants to make sure it's done like properly, like very properly. So holidays, we're pretty good. The only time that we've had like issues when going on holidays has been at the airport. Like he's very much arrive at the airport hours early, get to the gates like an hour before, like, and I want to like look around the shops at the airport. I'm like, there's going to be a queue anyway at the gate. So like, I'll just be the last one in the queue. And like, I used to be chill about that. I'm kind of starting to see the benefit in just like arrive really early at the airport and just enjoy your life and just have a bit of a chill time. But I used to be kind of, I don't mind, you know, I'm happy to arrive last minute on trains. And if I miss the train, like, oh, well, then that's another adventure. And that used to drive him crazy. So we definitely had a few times at airports where I was like, you go to the gate, do whatever you want. I will come there in my own time.
So who makes dinner? Like tonight, will you all dine together after your massage?
Yeah. So we both make dinner, but I probably enjoy making dinner more. I like kind of making dinner is kind of like a outlet of creativity for me. So I like kind of just imagining what things might taste like. And I think putting together meals is makes me feel good. Whereas for Josh, it's more of a task that needs to be done if no one else is doing it kind of thing. So it's kind of, I'm learning to find that we have different strengths, and actually everything in a marriage doesn't have to be like 50-50. Like for example, if we come back from kayaking, he will, he'll just automatically put all the kit away. And I'm like, thank God for that, because I really don't want to be standing outside dealing with wet, soggy kit in the middle of the night when it's all dark and I'm just hungry and I want to go to bed. So oftentimes we'll come back from kayaking and it's dark, and he'll go outside and put the boats away and put the kit away and hang the wet stuff up, and I'll go inside and start dinner. And I'm actually learning to know that actually it doesn't have to be 50-50 in everything. There are strengths, and it's beautiful to lean into that.
So in the dresser, if we pull out his like the sock drawer, and then we pull out your sock drawer or stocking drawer, what will they look like?
I'm gonna tell you something. My drawers probably are tidier than his. I don't know why that is. I think Josh's perfectionism is very much about tasks and jobs as opposed to general cleanliness and organization. So it's not like he's not anal about it, but it's like when there is like a job to be done, he wants to have it done properly. Whereas I'm more kind of, I like the feeling of things to be fresh and alive. So like, you know, making dinner, it's like a light feeling, like, yeah. So my drawers would be kind of tidier.
So my wife is painting the living room now, which is fine as long as I don't have to do it. Okay. And as long as there's no expectation that I'll do it. Mm-hmm. But her love language is that we do things together like that. And so it's somewhat frustrating to her.
Right.
So do you all live in a house or an apartment? You live in a flat?
We live in a house. Yeah.
Okay. Do you own or rent it?
Yeah, we own it. So we actually just got it last year. So
congratulations.
Our own house. Thank you.
And you're a grown up.
Feel so blessed for finding this place and where we live. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous location, gorgeous house. And
so who
paints? I always come back and I'm like, I love our house.
Who paints?
No one has painted so far, you know, like we got the house in pretty good condition. and that was kind of, so we haven't actually had to do a huge amount of like DIY for the thing of the house. But like, for example, Josh built a decking outside so that we could see the view better. So he's kind of more into the DIY jobs like that, I would say. Whereas I'm more kind of the decor and making things look pretty, making things, you know, the color palette and stuff like that.
So in a minute, you may hear Freddie drive by with the riding lawnmower.
Uh-huh.
So that's 40 or 45, somewhere between $40 and $50. Absolutely worth it. What is an example of something you easily could do yourself, DIY, but it's totally worth it to you to pay someone to do it?
Cleaning. I just I just get no joy from cleaning. I get joy from tidying, but I don't get joy from cleaning. And it's a very weird thing. Like if like after a meal, or if I've just like prepared a meal, I very naturally like kind of make sure that the extra food is put away. Like anything is, if we need to put stuff in the rubbish or the compost, like that's put away. And I'll put all the dirty plates together to like tidy, but I just don't like putting them in the dishwasher or like washing them up. Like the actual cleaning part, So we had the cleaner around today, for example. Like the house cleaning was always just such a, nobody took joy from doing it. And and now we have a beautiful lady who comes around, and I feel so blessed to have her in my life.
And do you say thank you to her?
We have a really nice relationship with her, and I think it's really important to treat the people in your life as like real human beings and have a real relationship with them. Obviously it's not always kind of realistic to go into a full-blown detailed conversation with everyone, but I actually find a lot of joy from connecting with people that I probably might, you know, I might never see again, like people like cashiers and in shops, or like, you know, smiling to people on, you know, streets and stuff like that. Like sometimes I find that that's a more joyous feeling than even kind of having a full-blown conversation with a friend, because with a friend there's like, you know, there's a lot more dynamics, whereas with a stranger I just find that sometimes it's the dynamic is simple. It's like you don't know each other, there's no expectations, there's no ties, there's just raw human connection, if you choose to tap into that. And so I often like tapping into that, but with the lady who comes around to clean, she's I just feel so grateful for the support network that I have for things like that.
T.S. Eliot noted that in London, people look straight ahead. They don't look at people. They'll just look ahead. They look beyond mm-hmm. you. And that people in New York look down to make sure that they don't make eye contact. You don't live, I gather, in like the heart of the urban area, right? Mm-hmm. But the suburbs, there's such this massive sprawl. It's such a sprawling place. In what situations by culture is it okay to make eye contact with someone in England? And when is it not okay, awkward or forced to make mm-hmm. eye contact and to speak, to say good day or good morning? Or
I think like if you're on a walk, like a hike, and you like come across someone, they're always like hello, good morning, good morning, hello, good day. And I really like that, like you wouldn't pass someone without making eye contact and without saying something. I think like if you're actually in the town, it's a bit of a sensory overload if you were to make eye contact with everyone. So a lot of time people will avoid eye contact. But I kind of look at everyone. maybe not everyone. Sometimes I'm funny. Like I have like my introvert days and I have my extrovert days. Like I don't feel like I'm one or the other. I'm probably more introverted, but when I am extroverted, I'm like very extroverted. But when I'm introverted, I'm just like, I want to be invisible. Like I want to walk through town and I want to be in a coffee shop where I'm just invisible and nobody, there's no eye contact, there's no nothing. I like being in the energy of the hustle and bustle. But there's some days where being invisible feels kind of safe and comforting. And there's some days where I like want that energy exchange with people, and I will make eye contact with everyone and kind of smile and I'll kind of like read and I'll try to like read what their story is and their energy is that day. And I'll kind of, and I don't know, I kind of like that. I like people watching, but I like people watching from like a, you know, in the ideal world, you can people watch without them watching you back. Like from a cafe or something, inside of a cafe and people are walking on the street.
What type of work environment drains you and what type of work environment energizes you as an introvert?
When you say work environment, you mean actually like doing my work?
Or... Yes.
I like having a bit of predictability with my work environment. Like, for example, my husband, he loves the idea of like just grabbing his laptop, driving off to a beautiful place in the van and just like setting up in the van and working from there. Like mentally, there's a lot of, like that creates a lot of instability for me. Like I like the work environment being like a stable, like safe container almost, because like in my work, there's a lot of creativity involved. There's a lot of the looseness comes from my work. So the work environment I feel needs to be kind of the base, the stable base. I actually really love working from home on my own. If I was working from like an office or a co-working space, I think I would probably get distracted quite easily. But the other place I really like working from is cafes, where I can just be ignored and just blend into the hustle and bustle, and that kind of I find it quite stimulating, and I can be really productive in those environments as well.
What's the difference between a cafe, which you feel this is perfect, I need to come here once, twice a week, and one which is like, ugh, this doesn't work?
You know, the cafes that have soul versus the cafes that are like, here's a table, here's a chair, here's your food, or like drink. And I think not always, but often, kind of the more like chain cafes, this might not be a very popular opinion, but I found that the chain cafes have kind of, they've been around for long enough and they've experimented with trial and error long enough, and they've done enough market research to know how to add a little bit of soul to their space. Whereas like just kind of an independent cafe, oftentimes it's about set up in a nice location, give good food and good drink, and the environment is kind of like the place that it all happens in. There are some really nice exceptions to that, but I find that the kind of like Costa, for example, is like is basically kind of the Starbucks of England, and they have really nice cozy settings, and it's kind of like it feels like a big warm hug, and there's the hustle and bustle, that like sound of like coffee shopness going on around you, that and you like people come, people go, so I really like the kind of the busy environment as well that contributes to that, which again an independent cafe often tends to be quieter, which is great if you actually want to like sit down and have lunch with your family, but if I'm working, I prefer like a busier environment.
Is there a cafe, a pub, or a restaurant, a diner, where people know you by name and you know them? Is there somewhere where if you walk in, they will call you by name?
Yeah, there is a very niche little pub in where we live called The Barrel. And it's a tiny pub in the basement of like I guess the guy's house, but it's got a lot of soul, and they have like country music playing, like folk music playing, and it's only open very short hours. It's like Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays between something like 6 or like 5:30 and 9 p.m. So it's not like it's very kind of like we're open for these hours, and the guy is kind of very clear on his rules. He's like, no phones, otherwise I'll be confiscated. He has basically an invisible shot dispenser, so you don't know how much is left in the dispenser, so you can get a free shot, but if you're the one to finish the bottle, you have to pay for the entire bottle. So he's just got some like really fun niche stuff like that. And he also takes, and because it's also kind of niche and personalized, he takes the time to really get to know everyone that comes. So we've only been here for about less than a year, but he already knows me and my husband, and he'll like say hi and give us a hug when we come in. And it's really nice to have that recognition.
How did you find this guy?
Like, it's the pub is in town, so you can see it, and it's always really busy. So like any local, that is kind of where they go. And because he has like the music is actually really fun. It's like they do like sing song music, and like kind of they have like the same band coming, so it's got a very good local reputation. So I think that's how we found him initially. But yeah, once you know, you kind of go back over and over again.
Do people sing along?
Yeah, there's in Cornwall, there's quite a strong culture of like the Cornish shanties and sea shanties. They'll give you the lyrics and you'll kind of mumble them along the first few times. But me and my husband really got into it, and we've been listening to them on Spotify and learning all the words, and we'll like sing along to it in the house sometimes now. So now we are equipped. We are well practiced students.
Are you into country or bluegrass?
What's bluegrass?
That's wonderful that you don't know that. Bluegrass is white people blues in America. banjo, fiddle,
okay, got
folk
you. Yeah.
Music. It comes from the Celts. It comes from Celtic.
Yeah. So Celtic.
Scots Irish.
So, you know, before moving to Cornwall, I wouldn't say I was that into Celtic music. But now I've moved in, I'm very much into it. Yeah, I would say country music, folk music, Celtic music. Yeah, really fun.
On a scale of what are you talking about, I don't even know and don't care, 0 to completely obsessed, 24/7, where are you with the Royals?
Does that answer your question?
Over it? Tired?
I think it's gone down. I used to be kind of maybe like a 5, just kind of it's they're interesting, they're amusing. It's kind of like an amusing little bubble that they live in. But since this Harry and Meghan stuff came out, it's just it's just kind of got really messy and kind of almost like, why are we even, you know, just why is this even something that's such a massive deal in the world right now? And also kind of it highlights how much pain there really is in order to preserve such a perfect, flawless image, how much pain there is behind the scenes. And just like layers and layers and layers of misunderstanding and hurt that, quite honestly, you know, all families have, but you have this one family that's their entire existence is based on holding up a facade of being flawless, basically, and being kind of clean from the dirtiness of the world, which I think comes at a really big price. So kind of over it.
Do you have any personal memories of Lady Diana from the television?
No. I was born, I believe, the year she died, or maybe only a few years before she died. So I only hear stories of her from my parents, or my mum and the in-laws. So no personal memories.
Mm. I think that might have changed things.
Mm.
So I'll ask you the same question about just try to separate it from your mother and your relationship with your mother. Are there parts of you where you say, well, obviously you don't live in Turkey and you could, you live in England. I gather your husband is British. Is that
correct? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why live in British, and what part of your sort of personality and self do you say, oh, when that comes out, that's British, that's not Turkish, that's not European, that's distinctly British?
Yeah, I think I have a lot. I'm feeling kind of more and more British than I am Turkish these days. First of all, the way I speak, people say it's like really posh. I think maybe also like on things like this, on interviews like this, I have kind of like a cleaner British that I speak than well British is even a very American way of saying it, a cleaner English than if I was speaking to my sister. Like if I was speaking to my sister, like I speak a little bit more like I can't even do it.
Try. See if I can hear it.
Let me see. Let me get myself into the headspace and talk into my sister. I can't, literally. How you doing? I think I do like maybe like a bit of a baby voice combined with a bit of a Turkish mixy accent. What are you talking about, La? Don't be stupid. And we'll be like, you idiot. So I think, yeah, a bit more of a baby voice and a bit more of a Turkish-y accent mixed in there. And a lot of my family members will say, like, if they hear me on a podcast like this or if they listen to, like, a video that I've released on LinkedIn, they say, you sound so proper. So it's I definitely have, like, a outward-facing English versus, like, a... and like even with my husband I'll have a bit more of a I don't know if it's like a baby voice, but it's like a softer it's not so crisp.
What do you do videos on? Are you a YouTube star? Should I know you?
No, so these are LinkedIn videos. Most of my marketing that I do for my business is on LinkedIn, and I create content. So I create quite a few videos, some of them like edited, some of them just like shot and posted for LinkedIn. And the idea is that building a bit of a community there, people get to know me. And ultimately that's where most of my business comes from.
What appeals to you about marketing? How is it it's sort of a natural extension of your personality?
It's marketing is like a very broad term, right? So it's not marketing specifically that appeals to me. It's the ability to, there's two aspects to it, because I do messaging. I help people with their message and helping them find ways of a core way of talking about or communicating what they do in a way that moves people, in a way that people get what they do, in a way that moves them emotionally, and in a way that's like so digestible that people can remember and repeat it to, you know, other people. And there's two aspects of that I really love. One is this ability to translate the gold inside of someone and get that heard and seen by other people. I call it, my program is called Find Your Roar. Because of this, you know, it's a very visual thing for me. I look at everyone in the world, you know, everyone with this, there's just pure, beautiful gold inside of them. And sometimes there's some translation issues of how that is translated into the world. I feel very honored to be able to help with translating the gold that people have inside of them into the world, and getting that seen and heard by the people that gold can actually start to manifest itself into a real life thing by inspiring action in others. So that's one. But the other thing is I just really find it satisfying to capture complexity and understand it and organize it and package it in a way that suddenly complexity is something digestible, it's something actionable, people can get it, and it inspires some sort of a movement out of that. And also a lot of the clients that I work with, what they do is very nuanced, it's very like complex, there's a lot of different angles to it, there's lots of different people that they're trying to speak to, that what they do isn't just one thing, they do multiple different things, they go about it in different ways, the thing that sets them apart from other companies that do what they do is like this very nuanced thing. So there's a lot of complexity that you're trying to capture, and I really love understanding the entire thing and pulling out the thread of stories that kind of most impactfully communicates the groundbreakingness of the work that they're doing.
What pathway led you to this? What did you do? What is your resume, your CV look like?
The most random pathway that you could ever imagine. I once was on a sales call and the guy asked, so do you have like a degree or something in marketing? Like, do you have any like qualifications? And I was like, at that moment, I realized he was talking to the wrong person. If you're looking for degrees, I'm not your person. No, I don't have any degrees in marketing or any prior experience in business even. So this is, I guess, my story. I graduated in geology.
From
Exeter University. And it was really fun to study. There was the capturing complexity of like what's happening in nature, reading it, pulling out a story of, okay, by looking at all these rocks and looking at all this complex data, the story that comes out of this is this used to be a tropical environment. And because it was a tropical environment because the sun was in the moon and then this and then that. And you're like, oh, it makes so much sense. So you're very much kind of, it was speaking to that part of me that finds organizing complexity and pulling a story out of it. It was speaking to that part of me. But the jobs to do with geology really just didn't inspire me. There was, you know, it felt like, now that you know all of the secrets of Mother Nature, why don't you tell us all the secrets so we can mine her and dig her and make money off of her? And you know, it's kind of maybe not so fair to the whole of the geology industry, but I just wasn't so inspired by the job prospects. And I felt that there is a more wholehearted way that I can make a contribution to the world. So I actually kind of made a radical decision when I was graduating that I wasn't going to go into that industry. I wasn't going to kind of just see if I liked it or try or just dip my toe. And I was like, nope, not going to happen. So I ended up taking kind of a bit of a 1 year gap year. And during that gap year, quite a few things happened, but I had one rule. And the rule was, I'm going to make money during this gap year only by jobs that feel exciting to me. I'm not going to do jobs just for the sake of doing a job like bartending or like cleaning or whatever. Like, I will only do jobs that in some way inspire me. Just a corner of that inspires me, or this, a corner of this inspires me. I ended up becoming a yoga teacher, teaching yoga. I ended up working with teenagers and taking them on excursions, hiking excursions, where we had like campsite chats about conversations of transitioning into adulthood. And that entire year got me reflecting back to what my inherent strength is, before I ever was trained, before my degree, before anything. Like, what is like the superpower that I have that I started learning, I started training in from like the day I was born? And it kind of turned out that this fact that I find translating complexity and understanding complexity and pulling the story out of it isn't a coincidence. It is actually a survival mechanism that I developed when I was a kid, because when I was a kid, my parents were going through quite a bit of a turbulent time. And as a kid, I didn't really understand what was going on, right? I just was confused. All I could see that my parents weren't particularly happy with, and they were, you know, at one point my mom was quite depressed and I felt very helpless. I was like, okay, mom's depressed. I'm very confused about what is happening. I can't do anything about it. And they don't seem to be doing anything about it either. So we're just going to sit in this, like nothing's going to happen. And I think I developed started developing this skill of reading the room, reading the different complexity of dynamics that was happening, the emotions that people are feeling, what they're needing, why they're needing that, and really kind of starting to, you know, get into, you know, the first, I guess, complexity that I was ever exposed to was human emotions and energy. And so I got really good at just being a sponge for all of that, and then starting to develop the part of my brain that made sense of it all. And I I got really good at understanding, reading what the room, understanding what people need, and starting to inspire some action that will take people towards what they need. So that was kind of the superpower that I realized that I had during this gap year. And then I was like, okay, so how can I translate this into some sort of a tangible job? So initially I started off working with gap year students who were like me, kind of graduated, didn't know what to do, wanted to kind of find their strength. That kind of didn't really work out. It evolved into career coaching, which kind of worked out, which evolved into life coaching, which evolved into therapy. And I was like, whoa, we're getting a little bit too deep into the kind of the traumas and the PTSDs. And I'm like, I didn't sign up for this. Like, what I really like is the grabbing, like helping people understand their, you know, getting the gold and translating that out into reality through this skill of understanding complexity and organizing it. So when I felt like it was going down too far down the therapy route, I kind of needed a bit of a reassess. And by pure chance, one of the sales calls that I had was with a tech founder who was like, look, I love what I do. That's not the problem. Because a lot of people I spoke to at the time, it was like, I'm earning good money, but I don't love what I do. But this guy was like, I love what I do. That's not the problem. The problem is when I speak about it to investors, they roll their eyes. He had a credit system security kind of technology company of some sort. And he actually ended up ghosting me. But it was interesting because that opened my eyes to, you have all these tech founders in the world that have... They have something really valuable and they've created it. Like, it's there, but it's like, it's not getting through. People don't understand it. People are walking straight past it. So I experimented with translating my skills that I used with the career coaching of kind of like capturing complexity, understanding what this gold was and articulating it. And kind of the process evolved from there. The more people I worked with, the more the process kind of shaped itself and whittled itself until this point where now I've got kind of a predictable, proven process, a messaging process of helping people articulate what they do in a way that does justice to how groundbreaking what they do is. And it's actually evolved further than tech founders now. I work with coaches that are more in the personal development space, consultants, service providers, recruiters, and even started to work with some people in the entertainment industry as well. But it started off with helping tech founders inject some emotion into their pitches.
How do you go about when you're dealing with very either nuanced or highly technical skills? Mm-hmm. And people are, their very problem is having a difficulty in articulating the value of it and understanding mm-hmm. why people don't see the value that they see so clearly as world changing. How do you draw it out of them as somebody who comes to it with a blank slate? You're like, I believe you, this is world changing, but I'm not even mm-hmm. a math major. So mm-hmm. how do you ask those questions that get them to not sort of treat you like an idiot, but also to get them to articulate their own value in a way that can be understood? That distillation process, by the way, and I love the metaphor of gold, because gold has to be refined. In the raw, it does not have value. How do you draw that out? How do you both synthesize, simplify, and just dig out? How do you draw that out? What's your process?
I always come to all of my clients, no matter how complex or deep, deeply technical their solution might be, with the very strong knowledge that it doesn't matter how technical what they're doing is, they are trying to speak to humans, and it is a human story that needs to come out of this. So if they, unless they have a product that really is nobody wants, which they wouldn't be in business if that was the case, if they have a product that people are paying for, then there is a human story in there that that is powerful enough to move people. It's just not getting out to enough people. So I go into it with a very clear knowledge that I know what I'm looking for. I don't need to understand. I don't need to become an expert in everything they're an expert in. I am looking with a flashlight for a very specific thing, which is the human story. So I've developed a very specific process that helps me pinpoint the human story. So there's a very specific series of questions that I'll ask them, which inspires and kind of invites out this human story and elements of this human story, which I then pull together and put into and kind of organize into their narrative. Oftentimes, when they're answering these specific questions, they'll answer it in very technical terms. And if I have no idea what they're on about, I will just keep on asking questions. No matter how stupid I sound, I'm not afraid of stupid questions. Until I get to a point where I'm like, so this is what I'm hearing from you, and I will translate it back to them in human terms.
They're not stupid. Yeah. They're simple. They're yes. simple.
Yes, exactly. And it is amazing, actually, when it comes to pulling out the human story in like a highly technical solution, how little you have to dabble in the super deep technicalities of it, like how little you actually need to get into the you know, I don't need to become like an AI expert in order to create a really powerful AI story, because the human story is actually a lot more high level and emotion based than the technicalities, and often the detailed technicalities don't become relevant until very further down in their process, you know, in their sales process. So
I love what you just said. That is that the emotions are higher level, because we think, because this noggin up here sits above the heart and the limbic system, that we think it's running things, and it's not. The really higher level human values are in the middle of my chest.
Yes.
They are emanating from the middle of my chest and not from my big old gray brain.
And that's rooted literally in like our brain biology. Like it's not even psychology, it's biology. Like the actual physical part of our brain that drives action is also the same part of our brain that's in charge of emotions. So when you feel something, it's very easy for it to translate into action. Whereas the physical part of our brain that's in charge of understanding things and logical things is not actually in charge of action or language. The part of our brain that's in charge of action is connected to emotion. The part of our brain that's in charge of language and speaking is the rational thinking mind. So actually the rational thinking mind is much easier to talk about, but it's actually the emotional part of our mind that is the part that translates into action. So it's not a theory, it's rooted in biology.
And I gotta hammer it home. This is what we have that the bots don't.
Yeah.
As that they bots, they don't know how to feel.
They don't feel. And actually,
and they don't know. Well, no, it's that they don't know how to feel.
Yeah.
And it's whether you believe that you can teach a bot how to feel. You can teach it you can teach it to mimic. But like I like to say, you know, but a bot's never going to have a period. You know, a bot doesn't have diarrhea. Yeah. So all of their understanding of diarrhea is going to be from an intellectual point of view, from whatever we can tell you. It's yucky, it's icky, it's smelly. Well, they can describe it, but they cannot come, they can only come up with other iterations of those descriptions.
Yeah. I think that a robot can learn how to emulate a feeling. Like, if someone says this to you, you should, you know, your feeling should be angry. But I believe that raw feelings like love, like, you know, the raw human needs that we have, it's not something that you teach. It's something that we fundamentally have, that we've, that I actually believe ties into our spirituality. Like, we have this very fundamental need to connect to something bigger. And I think that our most key emotions, like love, like gratitude, like expansion, like feeling alive, all come from a place of connecting to that something bigger. And, you know, bots don't, there's no element of spirituality for bots, I guess, which I think is the key, the foundation on which most of our human emotions are built upon.
Articulate, if you would, 3 minutes or less, what you mean by spirit. What is your experience of spirituality in this incarnation?
Yeah. I have a very no fluff way of looking at it. I look at it like this. We are all made of the same ingredient as everything around us, and that is energy in its most broken down form. If you broke everything down, it is made of energy. And, you know, I like this kind of metaphor that we're all stardust. It's kind of a similar metaphor. My spirituality stems from this concept that we are literally the same thing as everything around us, not just the humans, like my cells. If you broke me down, I am made of the same ingredients as, you know, that painting behind me, or the individual specks of paint and the canvas that creates it. And I think that, for me, creates a sense of incredible connection to everyone and everything around us, and an incredible sense of selflessness as well. So that's the kind of the basis for my spirituality. And from that, I have, you know, I've got the belief, and in the possibility of the belief has opened up for me, that because everything is connected, there are connections and there is happenings in the universe that might not necessarily make sense, or might not necessarily be able to be observed so in a linear way, because everything is connected to the point that we can't even comprehend. So therefore, the second level of my spirituality is, because everything is connected, there are going to be cause and effects and connections that I can't make sense of, but that do affect me, and I just need to surrender to that. So there's kind of this so that's kind of where the possibility of this universal, I guess, law comes through. And I don't really like the word law. Very basic nutshell, that is the heart of my spirituality.
In your experience, how do you tap in to that power?
It is a practice of constant self-awareness and connecting to the observer in my mind, basically kind of transcending who I think I am. You know, am I the girl that always dances? No, because when I'm not dancing, you know, I'm another person. Am I the girl that gets triggered when people can't take care of her emotions? Maybe when I was a kid, but I'm not that person. Am I the girl? Am I the messaging? You know, and kind of just constantly transcending my sense of identity through a practice of connecting to the stillness of, you know, of the universe, of the moment, and connecting to a place of who is the when I strip away all these layers of who I think I am, who is the observer that's left? But yeah, that kind of makes it sound like it's a really fancy practice. The very heart of it is stillness and connecting to a sense of being the observer and connecting to a sense of I'm not just, you know, an animal just trying to survive day to day. Like that is the form that I'm living in, but within that form is an energy that is trying to connect back to everything else around it. And in order to survive as this animal that I exist day to day, I need to kind of buy into the illusion that I'm separate, because otherwise, you know, if I've really, really, really embodied the fact that I was completely, I am everything else, then why would I feed myself? Why would I even get on this call with you? Because, you know, like shattering my sense of identity would mean that I couldn't exist as this form that I'm in, which is an animal that needs to believe in the illusion of separateness. But I think, yeah, just the awareness that I am an animal, that kind of buys into the helpful illusion that I'm separate from everything else, but also aware of the fact that really I am connected to everything else around me. And as often as I can, I connect to that awareness through being in nature, connecting to stillness and gratitude, actually. I don't know if that any of that makes sense. It probably makes me.
I want you to be my Swami. I want you to be my guru. If you can't get outside into nature, and if you're not making a gratitude list or saying a prayer of gratitude or whatever, this connecting process, if we were to watch you, what does it look like?
You wouldn't see anything if you watched me. It's a very internal process. You would see a lot of breathing, a lot of deep breaths. And that's it. And this is the beauty of it. It's not an action. It's a perspective, and it is an entire, yeah, it is expanding your internal world without necessarily.
Do you close your eyes?
Sometimes.
Do you turn sometimes off the television?
Yes. Yeah. So kind of trying to stay away from technology as much as possible, but also being aware that technology isn't, you know, is also part of this universe that has been created because of the minds of all these people that are also made of the same ingredient as me. So kind of it's not a hard and fast rule, basically.
Do you need to be sitting?
Sometimes it's not an action, Stuart, that you know, I say, okay, now I am connecting to the universe. It's an entire state of being constantly. So sometimes there are actions that help me connect to that, you know, sense of connecting to the rest of the universe more strongly, like when I officially, like, I am now meditating, or I am now doing yoga, I am now going for a walk and, you know, enjoying the sunshine on my face. But it's actually all the moments in between as well that it's, you know, it's a constantly living and breathing state of mind. So that's why I say kind of it's not necessarily it looks like a certain way from the outside, because it's not that when I've got my eyes closed, I'm connected to the universe, and when I've got them open, you know, I'm not. It's a constant state. But there are some actions like closing your eyes and meditating, being in nature, you know, stretching, breathing, dancing, that for me strengthen that that connection that I feel. You know, laughing with strangers, belly laughs with like people that I love, journaling, getting in the sea, like being around water, like all of those types of actions really strengthen that sense of awe that I feel and actually how interconnected we are.
I honor your time. I won't take more of it. God bless you. I want to talk to you a lot more. This was so good of you.
Thank you so much. It's amazing, actually, the process, like kind of starting with like simple questions and it's amazing kind of where that goes. So you're amazing at what you do.
You can find Alara Vural, the delightful Alara Vural, on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way. What she's saying is, know your roar, R-O-A-R, all about clarity and just packing a punch, focusing, but mainly messaging in marketing. I've booked a call next week. So there you go.
In Her Words is a production of the Queen City Podcast Network in cooperation with Balto Creative Media. Allison Andrews at Andrews Creative, Rachel Clapp Miller, and Roshonda Pratt are developmental producers. Sally Higgins at Higgins & Owens tries to keep us legal. Our music is A Day at the Park by the group Pictures of the Floating World. Your announcer is Catherine Smith. That's me. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and take a moment to rate and review. It really helps others find us. If you love us, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com. Look for Man Listening, one word, no spaces. A small investment makes a big difference in lifting up the voices of women.
A huge shout out and thank you to everyone who has supported this podcast from the very beginning. Whether it was manlistening.com, In Her Words, the podcast, or now my venture, voicelocket.com. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you for your support. We believe one voice can change the conversation. Thanks so much.